It's an honor and a privilege to be with you, to have the opportunity to take part in this great program. The outstanding lessons that have already been delivered, appreciate them so very much. Tremendous lesson just a few minutes ago by Brother Jesse Whitlock and the others that have already spoken. We love and appreciate the great Pearl Street congregation. Brother Dub McClish is world-renowned. I do not make that an overstatement. For his love of the truth, his defense of it, Pearl Street has a long and glorious history in the preaching and teaching of God's Word. Some of the greatest, finest gospel preachers down through history have had the opportunity to stand in this pulpit, and I am indeed humbled by that realization that such men as Foy Wallace Sr., Charles Mitchell Pulleas, and others have spoken at Pearl Street and numerous others, far too great to, as far as number, to mention. We appreciate the eldership here and the invitation to come. In examining our lesson this morning, we're going to be doing it in a somewhat different route than it is actually followed in the manuscript for certain reasons in conjunction with the program itself. First, we want to look at the fourth major point that I'll be dealing with, or as dealt with in the lectureship book, and that is this notion that the Gentiles were free in regard to righteousness, the Dan Billingsley doctrine. We want to look at that first, and then we'll go back to the beginning, as it were, and pick up with total depravity and, in order, imputed righteousness, and then, as time permits, the doctrine that grace excludes law. There are other speakers who have already dealt with that latter point somewhat and very well. And I understand Brother Mac Deaver will be dealing with it in an open forum type of setup in more detail. And so I will save that for last, and if time permits, then I will deal with some matters on that. But in this matter of free in regard to righteousness, or regard of righteousness, Brother Dan Billingsley teaches a form of the Old Bailes doctrine on marriage, divorce, and remarriage in seeking to justify people in their sins. In the McClish-Billingsley debate, on the first night of that debate, Billingsley introduced his position on Romans 6 and verse 20 in this fashion. He said, quote, "Paul said in Romans 6:20 that the alien sinner is free from righteousness. Man is the servant of that to which he yields himself to obey. Men cannot serve sin and obedience under righteousness at the same time," unquote. In his fourth negative of the first night, he went further on the matter. Quote, "Brethren, the Bible teaches that the alien sinner is free from righteousness. He's not bound by the obligation of the contract of the New Testament of Jesus Christ. He's a sinner, he's lost, he needs to be saved, but he's not bound by that law. He is free from righteousness." That's what Paul said. Until the alien sinner is instructed in righteousness, he is free from that righteousness, he is a sinner, he's lost, he can't be saved. He is condemned, not by the gospel, but because he has transgressed the nature of God that was a part of his created being. In this, Brother Billingsley goes on to cite Vine or Vinay and Thayer's lexicons in support of his fanciful notions. On the second night, in the his second affirmative, he returned to the theme and then said this, quote, "What is an obligation? It is a contract. What is a contract? It is a covenant between God and man, and without the contract there is no binding law. The alien sinner is not amenable or obligated or accountable to it." The bottom line of it is that Brother Billingsley holds to the notion that the only law, in effect, that the alien sinner is obligated to is that of an unwritten moral law. Unwritten, that is, save on the heart of the alien sinner. It is a variation of the Brother Bale's doctrine of the law written in the heart, which he attempts to force, or attempted to force, out of Romans chapter 2, verse 15. But Brother Bales, though questioned time and time again, never could tell what was written on the heart. And brethren, neither can Brother Dan Billingsley. In fact, I challenge Brother Billingsley. I challenge him to set forth and put down in writing what is written on the heart of the alien sinner of a moral nature, to express it and state it in precise terms. I dare say if you began going around the world and asking people what are your moral values, you would get a variety of answers. Brother John Grubb, who led the dismissal prayer in the last hour, was a missionary and co-worker in Taiwan, an island nation where some of the people 40, 50 years ago were headhunters, the Shandi people. And Brother Grubb well knows that and understands that. And he can verify what I am saying, that these people thought it was all right. It was in perfect keeping with their moral code to behead those that they warred with, and even strangers that would come into their midst from time to time. That somehow it was part of their religious beliefs. Was that written on their heart? Brother Billingsley needs to give answer to these matters and needs to be straightforward in it. Brother Billingsley admits, by his use of Vinay's expository dictionary, that righteousness, quote, is that which conforms to the revealed word of God. He goes on further than Billingsley really wishes he would. Vinay adds that the word concerns whatever, underline that, has been appointed by God to be acknowledged and obeyed by man, the sum total of requirements of God, hence religious duties. Unquote. Now, what about that unwritten law on the heart? If there's an unwritten law on the heart, doesn't that involve some sort of standard of righteousness? But the passage that Brother Billingsley tries to use in Romans chapter 6, verse 20, and the fashion in which he tries to use it, says, "For when ye were the servants of sin, you were free from righteousness." And he says that this means they had no obligation to be righteous, period. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that would include not only written revelation, that would not only include written law, it would include unwritten law on the heart, according to Vinay. And so this doctrine falls on its own weight. Brother Billingsley is involved in a massive self-contradiction that he cannot escape from. And he can use that to try to justify people in adultery, but God knows better. Some years ago, when this doctrine first reared its ugly head, in fact, about 20 years ago, Brother Billingsley introduced some of these basic thoughts and ideas at the Spiritual Sword Lectureship. I was sitting between Brother Klein, Bill Klein, and Brother Rex Turner, Sr., and Brother E.R. Harper. Now, brethren, I came out of ultra-dispensationalism. And when I heard Brother Billingsley setting forth his propositions, I said to Brother Klein and to Brother Turner and within earshot of Brother Harper, I said, that is nothing but a hybrid form of dispensationalism. You can put it down, that's exactly what it is. The only difference is the dispensationalist wants to get rid of baptism as necessary for salvation. Brother Billingsley wants to get away from the Lord's teaching in Matthew 19:9. There's not one whit of difference between them. The dispensationalist, the only difference is the dispensationalist would say that Billingsley needs to go a little further than making the dividing point at Acts 2, he needs to go on down to Acts 10, Acts 15, or Acts 28, and then get rid of baptism right along with his problems concerning marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Brethren, that is false doctrine. And Brother Billingsley cannot defend it. Brother McLeish did a tremendous job in refuting it. He got right to the heart of the matter. There are several questions Brother Billingsley needs to ask. Now listen to it. If the sinner is free from righteousness, as he asserts, and as he tries to use this phrase to teach, then it must be the case that he is free from all law, period. If he is free from all law, including this imaginary moral law that is unwritten, but it is written on the heart of the sinner, how then could an alien sinner be a sinner in any sense? There must be a law to violate in order for one to be a sinner. Sin, by definition, is the transgression of God's law. 1 John 3:4. Where there is no law, there is no transgression. Romans 4:15. Brother Billingsley needs to answer, how does one become an alien sinner? He never did answer that question when it was put to him by Brother McLeish, and I suspect he will never answer it. I'm not a prophet nor a prophet's son, but that will not hold. Where there is no law, there is no transgression. Yet Billingsley says he's a sinner. He says the alien is lost. He needs to be saved. Well, if he's a sinner, how? If he's lost, why? If he needs to be saved, from what? He hasn't done anything. He hasn't violated anything. He's not condemned by anything. He is absolutely teetotally free from all righteousness, given Brother Billingsley's position. The fact of the matter is, he is misusing this passage in a gross and a perverse way. He asserts that the alien sinner is not condemned by the gospel. Yet, the Bible teaches that he is. In fact, in Romans chapter 2, verse 16, Paul points out that we're all going to be judged by the gospel of Christ. That includes, my friend, the Gentile of Romans 1. That includes the Jew of Romans 2. And all men, Romans 3. Brother Billingsley doesn't give all that Vinay says relative to Romans 6:20. Vinay adds parenthetically, righteousness, quote, righteousness laid no sort of bond upon them. They had no relation to it, unquote. I wonder why he left that off. Why quote from Vinay concerning righteousness and then ignore Vinay's specific quotation and handling of Romans 6, verse 20? Brother Billingsley didn't want him to go quite that far. He assumes and asserts that there was no moral obligation from God to the alien sinner by the gospel. He says there was no contract between God and the alien sinner. The freedom of which Paul writes was not one that was permitted and encouraged by God, brethren, but rather it resided in the attitude and disposition of life that the alien held and still holds toward the gospel. They considered themselves free from righteousness, no obligation to obey God. And that's how they conducted themselves. And it is specifically that point that Paul is dealing with and showing that you do have an obligation. Brother Whiteside, in his excellent commentary on the book of Romans, observes, quote, "This does not mean that there was then no obligation resting upon them to do right. For in that case, they would not have committed sin in not doing right. They were free from righteousness in the sense that they were not practicing righteousness," unquote. Thayer, whom Billingsley also refers to, adds another tidbit on this text. And again, Brother Billingsley leaves it out. Thayer says, quote, "that this construction shows the force is that these were," quote, "left to their own will and pleasure," unquote. The force then is that Paul is emphasizing how these individuals prior to conversion had conducted themselves relative to the matter of righteousness. They considered themselves free, and they considered themselves able then, and having the permission to do as they pleased. Godet, in his commentary on this passage, says, quote, "It would be impossible to depict the degrading character of the former dependents in which his readers had lived," that is, Paul's readers, "more keenly than the apostle does in the words, free in respect of righteousness. The conviction of what is righteous did not for a moment hamper them in the course of life. This was an annoyance which they did not feel. To use the expression of Scripture, they drank iniquity as one drinketh up water." Unquote. That is the force of the passage. Mohl makes the observation that Paul plays with this phrase free, as it were, in order to prove them. Unquote. Freedom comes through the truth of the gospel. That's how you receive freedom. Paul is simply, in an accommodating way, using the attitude that the Gentiles had possessed relative to the matter of righteousness to emphasize this is the way you had behaved yourself in that condition, but you are obligated to behave yourself in a right and proper fashion. In fact, in the text of that portion in Romans chapter 6, Paul goes on to emphasize how that we are the servants of whom we yield ourselves to obey. And so if you're not obeying God, you're obeying the devil. You're obeying sin. And that was the condition of the alien sinners. Well, Billingsley's doctrine is false. It is damnable. And it needs to be exposed and opposed. On the matter of hereditary total depravity, Brother Michael Hatcher dealt with this in part and did an excellent job with it. We'll not go into great detail on the matter, but total depravity is a doctrine that actually was borrowed from Augustine of Hippo. Augustine had been a Manichaean, a branch of Gnosticism. And Augustine, though in many respects had some admirable characteristics, nonetheless had some failings, especially in a moral aspect. And he devised, and in keeping with his Manichaean roots, the idea that man was inherently sinful. The doctrine, and this by virtue of the sin of Adam, we had inherited an utter incapacity to do what was good or right in the sight of God. And so he began to teach the doctrine of original sin. And from this doctrine arrived at an idea of a necessitarian view of God, that God had to be in absolute control of everything, thus excluding and precluding free will until at least after conversion or after regeneration. Calvin came along some centuries later and codified some of the basic ideas of Augustine in what has been called or come to be known as the TULA. T stands for total depravity, U for unconditional election, L for limited atonement, I for irresistible grace, and P for perseverance of the saints. We're concerned with the T part of that acrostic. The idea of total depravity is that man is dead, T, totally dead. And that he has inherited, in effect genetically or by some other process, the very use of the word heredity would automatically hearken to the idea of genetics, that man has a flawed nature in such a way that he is totally dead and unable to do what is good or right. The hyper-Calvinist, especially such men as G.T. Shedd and others, believe that man could not even will to do good until after the Holy Spirit had entered into him and had infused his heart with saving grace. The Calvinists frequently use certain passages from the book of Romans. Romans 3, verses 10 through 18 is one of the prime passages. "As it is written," Paul says, "there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none that understandeth. There is none that seeketh after God. They are all gone out of the way. They are together become unprofitable. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. Their throat is an open sepulcher. With their tongues they have used deceit. The poison of asp is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways, and the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. The assertion by the Calvinist is that Paul demonstrates the utter depravity of the human race in this passage, and that even from conception. That, as Psalm 51, verse 5, in the NIV, as it tries to translate that passage, says, "Surely I have been a sinner from birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me." Now, I quote that from the NIV for this particular reason. That is a mistranslation of the text, number one, and it is an attempt, number two, to stick into the text the theology of John Calvin. Total depravity. And brethren, if we're going to permit such versions to be used in the pulpits, we should not be afraid then to use Calvinistic preachers. And brethren, it is a sin to teach Calvinism, to uphold it, to defend it. And it would be as wrong to have Billy Graham or to have John R.W. Stott or R.C. Sproul or any other Calvinist to stand up, or Arminian, to teach the idea of total depravity, to affirm it, to defend it. If that is evil, if that is sinful, that is just as wrong as to have a preacher who calls himself a gospel preacher get up and preach it and defend it and teach it out of Psalm 51 verse 5. On the basis of the NIV reading. There's not one whit of difference. It is a misuse of the text. It is false doctrine. At any event, Paul says, according to the Calvinist, that everything man does is evil. And inherently so prior to regeneration. In his debate with Ben Bogard, Brother W. Curtis Porter pressed the definition of terms on Mr. Bogard and really did a tremendous job of stressing that if man is totally depraved, that means absolutely, completely. There is not one good thought, one good action, one good word of speech that man can do, say, think, or whatever that would classify in any shape, form, or fashion in the mind of God as being good. Given that definition, that means that when that baby is conceived, not just born, but conceived, it is already as mean as the devil and can't get any worse. Already, teetotally, completely, absolutely depraved. Well, old Bogard said, "Well, I'm just saying that the total baby is depraved. I'm not saying that he's totally depraved. The total baby is depraved." But that's not... Well, really, there's no difference. If the total baby is depraved, then he is completely depraved. And you wind up in the same position. But even in his own speeches, he continued to use the phrase totally. And so he belied his own position. His own speech belied his position. Brother W. Brother Robertson L. Whiteside, in his debate with Ben Bogard, asked this question. He said, "Mr. Bogard, could God have given a gospel that was sufficient to reach the heart of the totally depraved sinner?" Bogard said, "Well, yes. He could have, but he didn't." Brother Whiteside then remarked, "Well, he's not as totally depraved as you said he was. And your doctrine now involves God in the position of having given an insufficient gospel, given a flawed gospel, given an imperfect gospel, and so on." And with that debate was virtually over with. Brethren, that's the truth of the matter. total depravity is an absolute absurdity. If there is anything total, it is its absurdity. The text that is before us does show the depths of depravity, and we use that word. There's nothing wrong with the word depravity in itself, to which humanity has sunk, but it falls far short of proving that such is hereditarily received at the point of conception. Rather, man becomes depraved by engaging in and practicing that which is evil and contrary, therefore, to God's will. The text does not assign this condition, then, to the lone cause of Adam's sin, as this theory infers. Paul had proven earlier that the Gentiles were sinners. He had demonstrated in chapter 2 that the Jews likewise were sinners. And now he is simply drawing the inevitable conclusion that therefore all men are sinners, even as the law taught. And thus he cites the book of Psalms. Man is a sinner because he sins. Go back again to 1 John 3:4. Sin is the transgression of God's law. Romans 4:15. Where there is no law, there is no transgression. Incidentally, brethren, the idea of total depravity, given the fact that those passages demonstrate that there must be law to sin, that those passages not only destroy the idea of total depravity, they also destroy the notion of Brother Billingsley's doctrine. And so if you're going to hold to one or the other, one is just as valuable as the other as far as this passage is concerned. Just go on ahead. If you're going to be a Billingsleyite and follow what Brother Billingsley teaches on this matter, just go and accept what John Calvin taught on total depravity. No difference. The condition or degree of depravity that is evidenced by this quotation is not said to begin at conception or birth, which is what Calvinism assumes. Notice what Paul specifically says, quote, "They are all gone out of the way." Well, they at one time were in the way. They were at one time in fellowship with God in some sense. "They are together become unprofitable." At one time, there was a profitable relationship. That is implied in the construction. Solomon said in Ecclesiastes 7:29, "Lo, this only have I found, that God made man upright, but they have sought them out many inventions." This accords with the numerous depictions of small children, especially infants, as Brother Hatcher detailed last night or yesterday, that in the Scriptures they are used as examples of innocence and purity and as genuine, that is, as far as their disposition and attitudes are concerned, are examples of the kind of character that ought to exist in those that are regenerate, those that are saved. We cite there Jonah 4, verse 11, and a number of other passages in the text. Another problem with the idea of total depravity and the use or misuse of this passage is that the language of the psalmist in Paul's citation is designed to simply emphasize the consequence of the active rebellion against God, both in its moral and spiritual effects, by virtue of a literary device. The text is not given to prove that everything that one does prior to regeneration is objectively evil. Not even the most staunch Calvinist can ultimately contend that and consistently uphold it, though some have tried. Romans 5:18 and 19 is another passage that's perverted by Calvinism to teach hereditary total depravity. That verse reads, quote, "Therefore, as by the offense of one judgment came upon all men to condemnation, even so by the righteousness of one, the free gift came upon all men unto justification of life. For as by one man's disobedience many were made sinners, so by the obedience of one shall many be made righteous." Now Calvinism affirms that Paul here teaches that Adam's transgression, verse 14, brought upon the entire human race condemnation for his personal guilt. Each individual then is guilty by way of heredity for Adam's specific act of sin. However, while Adam's sin did introduce sin into the world, and by its spiritual death, that is, separation from God, the latter passed upon all men, for that all have sinned, Romans 5, verse 12. The text does not teach that such a condition was genetically conferred. It does not teach that there is an inherited weakness there in man's genetic code. Adam's transgression served to create a condition wherein sin and death were unrestrained and thus rampant in the world. In fact, the fact of free will itself involved the capacity, the possibility of evil choices and thus of sin. The weakness of men and the flesh due to the temptations thereof implies then a proneness to sin when such choices can be made. Placed in such an environment, ushered in by Adam's transgression, humanity then is prone to transgression and even great moral depravity, as Paul demonstrates in Romans chapter 1. But that is a far cry from saying that man, as a baby, is a born devil. Far cry of it. You think about that particular notion that a baby is a junior Beelzebub or a junior John Dillinger or whatever. And that's the idea, that's the notion, that's the effect of this doctrine. It is absurd. There's much more that we could say concerning total depravity. Romans chapter 5 in particular, the use of that passage or misuse of it, as well as Romans 7, which was dealt with earlier by a number of speakers. In these particular passages, the remedy that Christ brought is equated with or contrasted with the condition that man has been brought under by Adam's transgression. If the Calvinist be right, and Adam's transgression placed all men, simply by its one act, in a condition where they are teetotally depraved, can't do anything good, and so on, then why is it not the case, logically, that the one act of obedience on the part of the Son of God and the shedding of His marvelous and precious blood, why is it not the case that every single individual since that point of time is born hereditarily totally pious? Why don't we start teaching that doctrine? If the other be true, the fact of the matter is it is not. It is an absurdity. If you can inherit the sin of your father, which Ezekiel 18:20 says you don't, refutes that. But if you can, then why can't you inherit the piety of your father or mother, as the case may be? If you inherit the sin of Adam, why can't you inherit the benefits of the obedience of Christ? Inasmuch as it is the sacrifice of Jesus that was intended to set at naught the effects of Adam's transgression. Are we going to conclude that the sacrifice of Jesus is somehow inferior to what Adam did? Ladies and gentlemen, that's why a lot of Calvinists wind up ultimately becoming universalists. They realize and recognize the logical connection between the two. That if the sacrifice of Christ is designed to set at naught the effect of Adam's transgression, and the effect of Adam's transgression involves total depravity, then obviously since the time of Christ, then there's no one totally depraved. No total depravity, no sin whatsoever, universal salvation for everyone. If not, why not, given Calvinism? The other two points I just want to briefly hit. The materials in the manuscript. This matter of imputed righteousness. There's a book by Brother David Chadwell, and there's another book. Jerry Jones has written a book up from slavery to sonship, published of all things by the Gospel Advocate, teaching the idea of imputed righteousness, which is premised on total depravity. The Calvinist says that there was a triple imputation. that when man is conceived, God imputes to him the guilt of Adam's sin. That's total depravity. That when Jesus died on the cross, God imputed to Jesus the sins of the elect. Then third, there is the imputation into the elect or to the elect. And the Calvinist quibbles over whether you can use the word transfer or infuse. Charles Hodge, in his commentary on Romans, oh no, we can't, to speak of it as an infusion isn't proper. It is a transferal. Well, the effect's still the same, whether you infuse it or transfer it. They're saying that the personal righteousness of Jesus is then applied to the individual at the point of faith, at the point of regeneration. And so one receives the personal righteousness of Jesus and thus is righteous in God's sight. You say, well, what's wrong with that? It is this. The righteousness of Jesus is part and partial of the very essence of deity himself, of God himself. You may as well contend for imputed omnipotence and imputed omniscience and imputed omnipresence as to contend for imputed righteousness. The quality and characteristic of personal righteousness possessed by the Son of God, Jesus, as deity, is proper to himself. And it is an essential aspect of his nature. And brethren, those who are teaching this nonsense, it is striking to me to read in some other publications, Brother Chadwell doesn't go quite that far, but he is teaching the idea of imputed righteousness. But the idea that we are somehow, as Brother Coates has said in refuting this nonsense, that we are somehow little godlets. That we ourselves, because we are children of God, are gods with a little g. That is coming out of this doctrine, the doctrines of Kenneth Copeland, Gloria Copeland, and Benny Hinn. In fact, I recommend you get a book, you preachers, The Agony of Deceit, edited by a Calvinist, Michael Horton, and that details this doctrine, this notion that somehow through the Holy Spirit we are ourselves incarnate, hence second incarnation, and the church is a second incarnation just as Jesus was the first incarnation. There's the godlet doctrine. And it's not coming out of the book of Romans. It is coming out of the writings of Kenneth and Gloria Copeland and those people. The personal righteousness of Jesus cannot be transferred. You may as well contend that you are God yourself as to accept that notion. Thank you.